Have you ever wished there was like a cheat code for understanding some of those really dense theological ideas? Well, today we've got you covered. It's going to be like a fast track to getting a grip on a really important moment in how Christians thought about, well, Jesus.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. We're diving deep, really deep into what's known as modern Christology, zeroing in on three really monumental figures in 20th century theology: Karl Barth, Rudolf Bultmann, and Wolfhart Pannenberg.
And to guide us through this, we've got some fascinating insights from a teaching session by Dr. Robert A. Peterson.
Exactly, and we're not just skimming the surface here. This is actually part two of Dr. Peterson's look at modern Christology, so we're picking up a conversation that's already rich and, pretty nuanced.
So think of it this way. We're going to try to pull out the core of what these theological heavyweights were saying, see where their ideas kind of like clicked and where they clashed, and figure out what kind of impact they had and still have on how we understand Jesus Christ.
And yeah, it can get a little complicated at times. That's why having an expert guide us through it is, well, so important.
So let's kick things off with Karl Barth. When we're talking about Barth stepping onto the theological scene, what stands out to you as the most, I don't know, significant thing?
Okay, so Barth really bursts onto the scene as a powerful reaction, a real pushback against liberal theology. He was a champion for returning to the classical orthodox understanding of Christ, the way the early church understood it, especially in those first 5 centuries.
Those really foundational years.
Exactly. And I think it's super telling that Barth was a pastor, first and foremost. He really seemed to experience the, let's say, shortcomings of that liberal approach in his pastoral work. And he has this famous line where he talks about his discovery of the strange new world of the Bible.
I love that, the strange new world of the Bible. It's so
Favorite.
evocative, right? But as we're focusing on his impact, we should also bring up some of the complexities Dr. Peterson pointed out. Like, Barth didn't hold to the idea that scripture was like absolutely inerrant.
Right. And there's this ongoing discussion, even debate, about whether his theology kind of drifts towards universalism, the idea that everyone will ultimately be saved. Even though Barth himself explicitly denied it, the idea persists.
Yeah. And then there's that very public and pretty sharp disagreement he had with Emil Brunner about the historical fall of humanity. It's a big point of contention.
For sure. Those are really important nuances to keep in mind. But I think at the heart of Barth's thinking, I mean, it's a central driving idea for him, is this concept called Christological concentration.
Okay, so for Barth, if I'm understanding this right, it's almost like you take everything you think you know about God and you focus it completely, like relentlessly, on Jesus. It's not just about Jesus, it's like he's the starting point and the ending point, like a
Yeah.
theological laser beam.
That's a great analogy. He even wrote in his Church Dogmatics, and this is really famous, that basically the whole of systematic theology has to be determined by Christology. For Barth, Jesus isn't just one piece of God's plan. He's the very beginning, the origin of all God's ways and works.
Which brings us to his take on the doctrine of election. And I have to say, it's a unique take, to put it mildly, and maybe a little bit mind-bending.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
Dr. Peterson mentioned that Barth was like the first one in church history to frame it this way. He said that Jesus himself is both the elect and the reprobate one, and he's that for everyone.
It's a pretty radical reinterpretation.
It's a huge shift from the traditional way of understanding it, like we see in Ephesians 1, where, we're chosen in Christ. And it makes you wonder if this idea kind of feeds into those concerns about universalism. If Jesus is both the elect and the reprobate for everyone, does that take away our individual choices, our individual responsibility?
It definitely raises those questions. I think it shows just how radically Barth centered his whole theological understanding on Christ. And, it got to the point where some people accused him of what they called Christomenism. The idea was that his focus on Christ became so strong that he kind of like pushed other important aspects of theology into the shadows.
Yeah, and his debate with Brunner over natural revelation really highlights that.
It was a really intense exchange.
Intense is putting it mildly. Like, can you imagine a theologian getting so worked up that he writes a whole book as a response and he titles it No? And not just a short pamphlet or so, a whole book. It really gives you a sense of how heated theological debates were back then.
But to your point about Christomenism, Dr. Peterson pointed out that Barth's insistence that all revelation comes through Christ seems to kind of overlook what we see in places like Psalm 19 and Romans 1, where it talks about God revealing himself through creation, through nature.
Right.
What do you think was behind Barth's resistance to that idea of natural revelation? Why was he so opposed to it?
Well, I think Barth was deeply worried that opening the door to natural revelation would also be like opening the door to human reason taking center stage.
Right.
Like it would lead to philosophical systems that might undermine the unique and, you know, authoritative revelation that we find in Jesus Christ.
So too much reliance on human thinking could actually lead us away from Christ. I think he saw it as a really dangerous path. But when it came to the early church's understanding of who Christ is, Barth was fully on board. He completely embraced the Chalcedonian definition, you know, the idea that Jesus is very God and very man.
And he really went to bat to defend it. I mean, when some of the more liberal theologians were criticizing the Council of Chalcedon, saying it was too intellectual and not really true to the Bible, Barth actually argued that the council wasn't trying to, like, solve the mystery of the incarnation with intellectual gymnastics.
Right.
He saw it as a really faithful attempt to see and honor that mystery for what it is.
Absolutely. He even went so far as to say that the formula of Chalcedon is basically an expansion and interpretation, what scholars call an exegesis, of that really important verse, John 1.14, the word became flesh. And, you know, speaking of ideas that can feel a bit abstract, Barth was also a defender of the idea of, well, the impersonal human nature of Christ.
Yeah, that's one that can definitely trip people up when they first encounter it.
For sure. So for those hearing that for the first time, what do you think Barth meant by that?
Okay, so the way I understand it, Barth wasn't saying that Jesus wasn't fully human. What he was saying is that there was never a separate human being, a separate person called Jesus, who existed before the incarnation, before he was conceived in Mary's womb.
Right.
So like, from the very first moment of Jesus's existence as a human being, his humanity was united with the divine logos. It wasn't impersonal in the sense of not having human characteristics or anything like that. It's more that his humanity never existed on its own, separate from the divine.
That's a really helpful distinction.
It was Barth's way of really emphasizing both Christ's full divinity and his full humanity, but without separating them into two different people. It's a subtle but important point.
Totally. And I think it's clear that Barth's work really helped revive interest in and acceptance of this ancient Christology. Even doctrines like the virgin birth, which had come under fire, especially in liberal theology, found new support after Barth.
Which is really interesting, considering how much he butted heads with Brenner, who, you know, actually denied the virgin birth. Dr. Peterson even quoted Barth, calling Brenner's denial a bad business. And he referred to the virgin birth and the empty tomb as absolutely essential signposts.
Wow.
It sounds like some serious theological sparring was going on there.
Definitely.
Brenner even called Barth a theological dictator at one point. That's pretty harsh.
Yeah, no kidding. But despite all that disagreement, Barth was always firm in his acceptance of the classical doctrine of the Trinity. And his starting point, surprise, surprise, was Christ.
You can set your watch by it at this point.
Pretty much. So his logic was, if Jesus is truly the revelation of God, then there has to be a God who is revealed in him, and that God must be triune, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
And the way he describes the Trinity is very Christ-centered too, right?
Right.
Like, God is the revealer, that's the Father, the revelation itself, which is the Son, and then the revealedness, which is the Holy Spirit. And Barth was really adamant that God is triune in his innermost being. It's not just about how God acts in the world. It's about who God is at his core.
Exactly. He made that distinction between what's called the economic trinity. That's how God works and interacts with creation. And the ontological or immanent trinity, which is about God's internal being.
Okay, that makes sense. So for Barth, Jesus' divinity was like the main event. But Dr. Peterson pointed out that in his earlier writings, especially in the early parts of church dogmatics, Barth's emphasis on the divinity was so strong that some people thought he was kind of minimizing or even like sidelining Jesus's humanity.
Right.
Later on, though, Barth seemed to strike more of a balance. He started emphasizing how the Son submits to the Father during his time on earth, not as like some kind of internal conflict within the Trinity, but more like the Son willingly choosing to subject himself to the Father as part of becoming human.
That's an important distinction.
And those statements he makes about Jesus's passion, you know, his suffering and death being both something God does and also the genuine suffering of a human being, that could so easily be misunderstood.
Oh, yeah. It's a really fine line he was walking there. It almost sounds like patripassianism, that idea that God the Father actually suffered on the cross, which Barth denied.
A lot of theological heavy lifting going on there.
There is. And in his later work, Barth shifted gears a bit. He started to focus more on Jesus as a true representative of humanity, a human being who is in partnership with God in the covenant. And he started to develop this idea that through Christ, all people can also have that kind of partnership with God.
Interesting. So right around the time Barth's influence was reaching its peak, a new voice, a very different voice, emerged and ended up steering Western theology in a whole new direction.
A very different direction is an understatement.
And that brings us to Rudolf Bultmann. I think it's safe to say that he's a figure who tends to provoke some pretty strong reactions.
You could say that again.
Dr. Peterson called him a genius, a true pioneer in a lot of areas of New Testament scholarship. I mean, the stuff he did with form criticism, biblical theology, and hermeneutics, it was groundbreaking. Mm. And his commentary on the Gospel of John is still really highly regarded today. But then there's that other side to Bultmann, where he takes this pretty big, some would say, radical departure from traditional or orthodox Christology.
And radical is putting it lightly. I mean, Bultmann flat out denied a lot of core Christian doctrines. The incarnation, as it's traditionally understood, the deity of Christ, miracles as supernatural events, the actual existence of heaven and hell, the physical resurrection of Jesus, and his literal second coming. All of it. He didn't accept it.
And it's so striking because, as Dr. Peterson pointed out, Bultmann was incredibly knowledgeable about the New Testament. He shared this anecdote about his seminary students being totally perplexed. Like, how could someone know so much about the Bible and yet not believe in, like, its foundational claims?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question.
It really makes you think about what it means to really know something, especially in theology.
Definitely.
Dr. Peterson talked about it as a kind of knowing that's rooted in faith and personal trust. And it's a kind of knowing that Bultmann, in his rejection of those core beliefs, didn't seem to have, at least not in the same way.
Right.
And the really big project for Bultmann was his program of demythologizing the New Testament. He started doing this after World War II.
It was a huge undertaking.
It was. Yeah. For those who might not be familiar with that term, what exactly did it mean to demythologize the New Testament? What was he doing?
Okay, so basically, Bultmann believed that the New Testament, the way we have it today, isn't just a straight-up historical account of what happened in Jesus' life. He thought it also reflects the theological beliefs and worldview of the early Christian communities who wrote it and passed it down. And he argued that over time, as those stories were told and retold, certain elements, what he called legendary elements, were kind of added in.
Kind of like embellishments.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. And one of the things he was most critical of was this picture of a three-decker universe in the New Testament. You know, heaven is up there, earth is in the middle, and hell is down below.
Yeah, that classic image.
He thought that was totally mythological, something people just can't believe anymore, especially in the modern world with all its scientific knowledge.
So he was saying those stories weren't meant to be taken as literal historical fact.
Right.
But he wasn't just trying to throw them out, right?
Right. It wasn't about getting rid of them completely. It was more about reinterpreting them, about finding the deeper meaning. He thought those myths served a purpose. He saw them as a way of expressing really fundamental religious experiences, especially this experience of being freed from sin through the message of the cross, through what the man, Jesus of Nazareth, had done and said. He wanted to get at that deeper existential meaning that he thought was underneath all the mythology.
And he was really into existentialist philosophy, right?
Mm.
Especially the work of Martin Heidegger.
Hugely influential for him.
And you can really see that in his work. He tried to take everything the New Testament said about Jesus and translate it into these anthropological and existential categories. He kept talking about this idea of reaching an authentic, believing self-understanding.
Exactly. He was convinced that understanding God and understanding yourself were deeply connected. And Dr. Peterson mentioned that a lot of radical left philosophers at the time were really into Bultmann's work. They saw it as lining up really well with Heidegger's existentialism. It's interesting, though. Bultmann didn't go as far as completely demythologizing the concept of God itself. It's almost like he drew a line there and said, okay, we need to reinterpret the stories, but the ultimate reality of God is still there.
So reinterpretation, but not elimination.
Exactly.
But this idea that all theological discussion, and especially talk about Christ, is ultimately about us, about our human condition, that's a huge shift in perspective, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Dr. Peterson even quoted this line from Bultmann where he says, every assertion about Christ is also an assertion about man, and vice versa. I mean, that pretty much sums up his whole approach.
It does, doesn't it? It's like the thesis statement for his entire project.
Right. And in 1941, he gave this really important lecture called New Testament in Mythology, where he basically laid out his whole argument that the New Testament is full of this mythological worldview, you know, divine intervention, supernatural miracles, the whole ancient way of understanding the universe. And he said none of it is believable to modern people anymore.
A bold statement.
It was. And he specifically called out certain things as belonging to this outdated mythological framework. The literal incarnation, where God takes on human form, miracles that break the laws of nature, the idea that Christ's death was an atoning sacrifice, the physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead, and the ascension into heaven.
So to be clear, he wasn't saying these things didn't happen. He was saying that the way they're described is rooted in this ancient way of thinking that we just can't accept at face value anymore.
Right. And again, his goal wasn't to just toss these ideas out. He wanted to reinterpret them, to find the religious experiences he thought they were pointing to.
And that interpretation of the cross was really central to his whole project, right? This idea that it's the pivotal event, that it's what brings about deliverance from sin. And it does that through our encounter with the man, Jesus of Nazareth, and the message that he preached.
Absolutely. The cross is everything for Bultmann. And this whole demythologizing program, it wasn't just about the stories. It extended to how he understood Jesus himself, the person of Jesus. Bultmann rejected that traditional view of a pre-existent divine being who's born miraculously, sacrifices himself, rises from the dead, and ascends into heaven. He wanted to translate all of that into these anthropological and existential categories that he was working with.
Right. It's all about what he called the meaning of the historical figure of Jesus for how we live our lives. So when the New Testament writers use language that Bultmann considered mythological to describe Jesus as coming from eternity, Bultmann saw that as their way of saying that Jesus was someone who couldn't be understood just based on his earthly life, on the historical details.
That's a really helpful way to frame it.
So in Bultmann's interpretation, this seemingly ordinary guy, Jesus, became the point where God's salvation breaks into the world. He called it this great eschatological event, something that changes everything, and it leads people to a new, more authentic understanding of themselves and their faith.
A believing self-understanding, as he put it.
Exactly. And that's a really different way of reading the New Testament than what we're used to, isn't it?
It's a huge departure. Dr. Peterson actually brought up this summary by Herman Sasse that kind of lays out, point blank, what Bultmann was rejecting about the traditional view of Jesus. The virgin birth. The idea that Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate to atone for sins, the physical resurrection, the ascension, and the idea of a second coming.
Wow. When you lay it out like that, it's pretty stark.
It is. And according to Sasse's interpretation of Bultmann, what was left after all that demythologizing, basically just this idea that after Jesus' death, the disciples somehow experienced an eschatological event of salvation that was associated with Jesus, and they called that the resurrection.
It's a very different picture. And, you know, this whole approach didn't just stay in academic circles. It really trickled down into theology more broadly, even popular culture. Dr. Peterson mentioned J.A.T. Robinson's book, Honest to God, as a great example of how those demythologizing ideas were put into language that everyday people could understand.
Oh, yeah. That book caused a huge stir, especially in Britain.
It really did. And those ideas that Robinson put forward, things like God being the depth of our being or the ground of our being, they really reflected this move away from more traditional supernatural ways of understanding God.
And some theologians took those ideas even further. Dr. Peterson talked about the whole God is dead movement, which was basically saying that traditional ideas about God were completely irrelevant in the modern world.
So, a pretty radical shift. But, as often happens, the pendulum started to swing back. And one of the key figures in that shift was Wolfhart Pannenberg.
A very important figure.
He, along with Jürgen Moltmann, represented a real response to these more radical trends, especially what Bultmann was doing with demythologizing. And Pannenberg had a really distinct way of going about things. He preferred what he called a Christology from below instead of the traditional Christology from above.
And that's a key distinction. What do you think was behind his reasoning for that?
Well, it seemed like Pannenberg thought that starting with the historical person of Jesus, like a real person who lived in history, and then working up to affirming his divinity in the incarnation, would be a much better way to talk about Jesus to modern people. especially people who might be skeptical of those more traditional starting points. You know, starting with the idea that Jesus is divine and preexistent. Traditional Christology usually starts with the preexistent Son of God entering human history in the incarnation.
Right, it flips the script.
Exactly. But the potential problem with this from-below approach, and Dr. Teterson pointed this out, is that it might be really hard to recognize what's truly unique and special about Jesus, his divine identity, if you don't start with that premise. How do you avoid just ending up with a really amazing human being, but not God?
Right. That's the challenge.
So it's like Pannenberg is saying, let's not assume a divine Jesus right from the start. Let's look at the actual guy, his life, what he said, what he did, and especially his resurrection. And then ask, can we make a case for his divinity from the ground up, a case that makes sense to people who are naturally skeptical? And that's a really different approach than Boltmann, who was really doubtful about how much we can actually know about the historical Jesus from the New Testament.
A very different approach, for sure. Pannenberg was absolutely convinced that we can get to a reliable understanding of the historical Jesus. Like, he believed there's a real person back there behind all the apostolic preaching, and he put Jesus squarely within the context of Jewish apocalyptic expectations that were swirling around at the time. Ideas about the end of history, the resurrection of the dead, the Son of Man coming as this cosmic judge, and the final judgment. And he especially zeroed in on Jesus's own claim, which was a pretty radical claim that he spoke and acted with God's own authority.
And Pannenberg called that claim proleptic. What did he mean by that?
So proleptic basically means it's not immediately obvious, not fully realized yet. It's like a claim that needs to be proven out in the future. It needs God himself to come in and validate it. And of course, when Jesus was condemned and executed by the Romans, it looked like, to everyone watching, like the ultimate failure. Like his claim was totally refuted.
The exact opposite of what he was claiming.
Right. And that's where the resurrection becomes absolutely central for Pannenberg. Like, there's no getting around it. He didn't see it as just bringing a corpse back to life. He saw it as God's big public statement saying, I told you so. Like, it was God vindicating Jesus and everything he had said and done.
Pretty dramatic.
It is. And Pannenberg saw the resurrection as this sneak peek, this anticipation of the final resurrection of everyone at the end of time. And he said it's the event that definitively shows us who Jesus really is.
So this whole Christology from below, starting with the guy walking around in Galilee and ending up at the resurrection, It leads to what Pannenberg called an eschatological Christology.
Right. And for him, the resurrection reveals that Jesus, this specific man who lived this unique life, is not just some human being. He's one with God. He is God.
And that obviously brings up the question of how we understand all that stuff in the Gospels about Jesus being subordinate to God the Father.
Yeah, it's a natural question.
How did Pannenberg square that circle?
Well, Pannenberg argued that this subordination that we see isn't a denial of Jesus' divinity. He said it's actually an expression of Jesus' essential eternal oneness with the Father as the Son. So as the one who was completely dedicated to the Father's will, who was perfectly obedient, Jesus reveals God's own nature. And because of that, he's inseparable from God. He is the Son of God, even before the events of Easter.
Okay, so what about the idea that Jesus existed before his earthly life, pre-existence, and the whole concept of the incarnation? Pannenberg was on board with those, right? Even though he wasn't starting there in his theological system.
Yes, he totally affirmed those doctrines. They weren't his starting point. But he firmly believed that the incarnation is this profound truth about God himself actually entering human form in the person of Jesus. And he saw that event as solidifying that unique father-son relationship within the very being of God. He even made a really interesting connection to the way we understand the Trinity.
Oh, how so?
So he pointed out that the early church first understood it as this two-in-one kind of thing at the incarnation, then more fully as three-in-one at Pentecost. And it's only later that they came to understand it as this eternal reality within God himself.
It's like working backwards from what we see happening in history to what must be true about God eternally.
Exactly. And for Pannenberg, that distinction that Jesus maintained with the Father during his earthly ministry, that's part of the very structure of the Trinity itself. So even though he's coming at it from this from below angle, he ends up with a full-fledged doctrine of the Trinity.
It's a roundabout way of getting there, but he gets there.
He does.
But there's this question that always seems to come up whenever you have what theologians call a high Christology, where you're really emphasizing Jesus' divinity.
Right.
And that question is, how do you make sure that Jesus' humanity, the fact that he was fully human, doesn't get kind of swallowed up, diminished, by his overwhelming divinity. How did Pannenberg handle that problem?
Well, he went back to the 6th century, and he picked up this concept from a theologian named Leontius of Byzantium about the impersonal humanity of Christ. And just to be clear, he wasn't saying that Jesus didn't have real human qualities or experiences. What he was emphasizing is that Jesus's humanity never existed as a separate person, apart from being united with the divine logos. And that union happened right from the very beginning, from the moment of conception.
It's not like there were two separate people, one human and one divine, inhabiting the same body.
All right.
It's more that Jesus's humanity was fully assumed, taken on by the divine Son. So Pannenberg's starting point is totally different, but his conclusions actually seem to be pretty similar to classical Christology and the Chalcedonian tradition, even though he uses different terms to talk about it.
Exactly. He talks about this indirect identity of two complementary total aspects to describe the relationship between Jesus's divine and human natures.
It's a mouthful, but it seems like he's landing in a similar place.
He is. And Dr. Peterson highlighted how good Pannenberg's approach is in some ways, especially how seriously he took the historical reality of Jesus and the importance of the resurrection.
Right. He wasn't just making stuff up.
Not at all. But Dr. Peterson also pointed out that Pannenberg got some criticism, too, for his approach. Some people thought he was a little too critical of certain parts of the Bible, and they thought he was using the historical critical method, you know, the tools scholars use to analyze ancient texts in a way that kind of dismissed evidence that didn't fit neatly into his system.
Like the virgin birth, for example.
Yeah, and Jesus's own awareness that he was Messiah and the Son of God. So Pannenberg's approach is really compelling in a lot of ways, especially for connecting with people who are living in the modern world and are kind of skeptical by nature. But there's still that question of whether he's really taking the whole Bible seriously, whether he's honoring the full witness of Scripture.
And Dr. Peterson also mentioned this other really interesting idea that Pannenberg put forward, this eschatological and hypostasis of all men. It's a pretty dense concept.
It is.
Basically, Pannenberg's suggesting that the really close connection between God and humanity that we see in Jesus, that's going to eventually spread to all of humanity in the future.
A pretty bold claim.
It is. And it makes you wonder if he's kind of hinting at the deification of human beings, like we all become gods in some sense.
And maybe even universalism, that everyone will ultimately be saved.
Right. And Dr. Peterson was pretty clear that he disagreed with Pannenberg on that point. So it's been quite a journey.
It has.
We've gone from Barth's very Christ-centered way of reaffirming traditional Christianity to Bultmann's really radical project of demythologizing the New Testament, and then to Pannenberg, who's trying to build this Christology from below. But he ends up affirming a lot of traditional doctrines. It's amazing to see how these guys were interacting, how they were pushing back against each other, and how they all had such different ways of approaching Jesus, who he is, what his life meant, what his death and resurrection mean.
And it's important to remember that these aren't just like dry academic debates happening in ivory towers. I mean, these movements have had a huge impact on how people all over the world understand Jesus.
Yeah, whether they realize it or not.
Exactly. So it really makes you think about which of these approaches, or maybe even a combination of them, makes the most sense to you, you know? And even more important, why does it make sense to you?
That's the key question. So here's a final thought for you to ponder as you go about your day. How does knowing about these different approaches to Christology, these different ways of wrestling with the big questions about who Jesus is, how does that impact your own faith? And how does it change how you see Jesus's role in the world right now? I think it's worth spending some time really digging into the work of these theologians and seeing how they're still shaping how people think about and practice Christianity today.